This week, some pint-sized scientists are called in to help save an endangered crustacean. Aquaponics proves to be a blooming success in growing fish and fresh veggies in a harsh outback climate. We'll taste test some of the best beef in the lead-up to the Royal Queensland Show and saddle up for the Halls Creek camp draft.
Oh, it's awesome. I love camp drafting. It's the best sport in the world. It dates back when we first started ringing and droving and stuff like that. And the ringers used to make up this as a game to them. And then they started professionally doing it as a sport. And it's just got bigger and bigger since then.
We'll join an enthusiastic Kayla Struber and 700 other drafters in the Kimberley later in the show. But first today we're off to a classroom in northwest Tasmania where some budding young scientists are learning all about a local endangered species.
These Grade 1 students can't contain their excitement. They're about to head out of the classroom to play in the mud. And it's all with their teacher's permission.
Please check you've got your bags, coats.
Hello, I'm Larissa Smith at Nixon Street Primary School in Devonport in northwest Tasmania. We're off to visit the nearby Don Reserve, home of a local endangered crustacean species, the Central North Burrowing Crayfish. Its habitat is under threat from urban sprawl, and these school children are taking part in a pilot program to monitor their spread.
If you're carrying gumboots, you'll need to have them with you as well. Please sit down here. We're just about ready to go.
The excursion has two parts. So the first part after we walk down to the bush reserve is to try and find out where the burrowing crayfish are in our search area. And we're going to need to find them but also mark them on the ground so that we don't tread on them and disturb them. And then we might do some things like measure the chimneys of the burrowing crayfish and the diameter, or how round the funnel is that comes into the ground.
Andrew Hughes is helping to run today's excursion. He's an education officer with the Bookend Trust, a not-for-profit organisation which helps educate students and communities about their environment.
Well, with Nixon Street, we're looking to pilot what will be a larger program next year of surveying the little critters that hide on or under the ground. And in this area, we've got this wonderful creature, the Central North Burrowing Crayfish, and we'd like to find out more about it. Nixon Street's going to help us.
Hello, my name is Deacon. I'm six. I'm measuring how big a crayfish hole is.
I found a hole!
They're hopefully going to dive into this concept of surveying, counting and sorting out this species where it lives in their backyards, bushland reserves, possibly private land in the council area, Latrobe and Devonport, and just getting on their hands and knees, using their eyes and ears and making observations for us.
Yeah, how would they fit in there? How would they fit in there? It looks bigger.
They're natural born scientific minds, which are always asking questions, as most parents know. And it's just about turning that questioning mind into something that they can help with in a large project. And we hope this will become a large project next year.
So will this scientific information that they end up collecting, will it go into something much broader that scientists within Tasmania can use?
I think the challenge for the scientists is to have hands on the ground and eyes out there that can gather the information that a small group of people just can't do. And so by engaging the students to be the eyes and the ears for the scientists and hopefully get good data, it will provide a much clearer picture for the scientists to build up strategies about how to look after this special species.
There are dozens of crayfish species in Tasmania, but the one we're looking for today is about the size of a large prawn. And it's only found in a small area between the Mersey River and Port Sorell. They dig deep and live in muddy burrows near a creek or stream.
Is that one there? Is that one there?
That is one as well. Very good.
Local crayfish expert Jim Nelson is helping these pint-sized scientists find signs of life in the mud.
They're endangered because they're in an area that's probably one of the highest development areas in Tasmania. So anytime there's a new housing subdivision going in or something like that, they're inevitably destroying habitat if there's any areas that are wet at all, and they tend to go in and drain those wet areas first thing, and then build their satellite little communities.
You've had a real interest in a range of crayfish for a long time. Tell me about that passion.
As you can tell from my accent, grew up in the United States, and I lived on a river which was a tributary of a Mississippi River, and for some reason I became fascinated with crayfish. I sort of saw myself as a little bit of an explorer trying to figure out where they lived, and one of my main passions was fishing, and the crayfish were good fishing bait, so that was kind of a motivating thing. I'm no longer a fisherman, but I'm still fascinated with crayfish. And I've carried out a couple of jobs sort of as a community education officer for out of the Environment Center in Launceston, a couple of years trying to educate people about looking after these special things that only occur in Tasmania. A lot of people see them as a nuisance, where we should be seeing them as something very special.
And you think that school children can play a part in helping to protect and educate their peers and their mums and dads about this little critter?
Well, exactly. They're the people that are going to either have these crayfish or not have them in their future, and the future's in their hands. If they can help educate the community, that's great.
We found a few of reefs.
Yeah, we've got heaps.
We've got three tanks and, I don't know, how many grow beds and about 400 odd fish.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of fish are you using here?
I've got 200 jade perch, and there's about 30 catfish that are sort of more or less to see how they go.
Even in your wildest imagination, you couldn't describe Lightning Ridge as a gardener's paradise. The landscape around this opal mining town in northwest New South Wales is pretty stark, and it's barren at the best of times. Marlock heaps and scrubby bushes dot the horizon. It's blistering hot in summer. But with a bit of water, some tanks, fish and vegetable seedlings, Ashley Steed has created an oasis right here in his backyard.
What sort of fruit and veggies are you growing in your grow beds?
Not a lot at the moment. Mm. We've just got tomatoes and cabbages and collie and broccoli and lettuce and beans and a few others.
Hello, I'm Sally Bryant. Ashley is a convert to aquaponics. It's the production system that sees fish and vegetables grown side by side in a closed water system. And he won't be the only one harvesting his backyard bounty if aquaponics educator Murray Hallen has his way. He's in the Ridge to help spread the aquaponics message. It's a special gathering of like-minded people.
Our business is aquaponics. We teach aquaponics to anyone who will listen to us. We discovered aquaponics about 9.5 years ago, and we've run with it ever since because we believe very much in what we're doing. We believe it's a way to provide food for people, especially in a country like Australia where you've got, you know, low water and all that sort of stuff. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do.
So what was your professional background before you got into aquaponics?
I'm a boat builder. So, you know, not...
So you understand how to keep things watertight?
Well, it used to be to keep the water out. Now we try and keep the water in. If your plumbing is good and you're operating the system in a closed-loop way, which is very possible to do, we've proved it over and over again, the only water you'll lose is what the plants actually use. So that's the most water-wise system you can possibly get. Because if you farm in the ground or garden in the ground, you're going to lose a lot of the water to the subsoil. You know, it'll soak away and be gone. And we just don't lose any water like that. And if we design our system well, we'll also minimise evaporation as well.
The other attractant about this is that you don't have any waste products that are going to impact on the environment. So you don't have excess nutrient making an impact.
Absolutely.
On the local environment.
That is so true and so important, because if we compare aquaculture and hydroponics, which are the two disciplines that have come together to make aquaponics possible, both of those disciplines have a problem with discharging wastewater. So the discharge doesn't happen in aquaponics because the water from the fish is moved through to the plant side, and the plants actually clean the water for the fish.
How finely can you tune this? I mean, I would imagine that there would be all sorts of levels
of operation for this sort of operation.
Of course. In a home system, we try not to push the boundaries too much. Mm. The temptation is to try and grow more fish than you really should. That's the most common temptation people fall into. And then they overdo it and they end up killing their fish. So we warn very strongly about that. You probably heard me in class this morning, warning very strongly about not overdoing the fish population. And that we call that the bloke problem, because blokes think they're going to grow fish bigger and faster than anybody else. So the bloke problem is the problem there. We just warn very strongly about that. But if you follow the simple parameters we give you and you don't overdo it and you have patience, then you'll be successful.
Interesting listening to the people who are here today giving their reasons this morning for coming and doing this course. What do you think would be the outstanding reason or the most given reason for people wanting to learn how to do aquaponics?
Food purity. Without a doubt, food purity. More and more people are wanting to get away from chemicals and additives and colorants. It just goes on and on the list of things. And so more and more people, you don't have to be a PhD to know this. It's, simple Johnny down the road can tell you that to be eating your food that's been bathed in chemicals, colorants, additives, it's just not good.
So who is interested in taking up the aquaponics message? Sandy comes from Walgett. She's interested in growing her own organic food.
Yeah, I guess my motivation the last couple of years or awareness has been around chemical use, having a history of nursing and using drugs all the time. I've seen and heard of people getting better by trying to eat organic or spray-free as much as possible. Today, I guess I've already learned in half a day that it's possible to set up a functional aquaponic system in a backyard. Small but really effective. And it is possible to grow veggies in a 40-plus degree climate.
So, back to Ashley Steed and his backyard aquaponics system. Was it easy to get this started? And, on reflection, has it been worth the effort? You sort of dived in with some help from the internet.
Yeah.
And over 18 months period, you've only lost 3 fish. Yeah. It's a pretty good track record.
Yeah, I think if that's all anybody loses, they'd be doing okay, yeah.
So how much investment of time has it taken you, each day to keep this ticking over?
Oh, not really much. It wouldn't matter if you didn't go near it half the time. You got to feed the fish when it's warm weather.
Mm. And
at the moment, they're not getting anything to eat.
Mm. Okay.
They're too cold to eat.
What sort of money did it cost you, do you reckon? Just, a ballpark figure to set it up.
I wouldn't have a clue. I never bothered about writing anything like that down, no. But I don't think it costs much, no. Well, I'm sure we've got more out of it than what we've put into it. And I'm retired, so I've got to have something to amuse me, haven't I?
Yeah. Also, it seems to me that it's, in a way, the perfect solution for a place like Lightning Ridge, which can be a pretty harsh place to live in terms of growing things.
Yeah, but although it is a harsh place to live, we grow mangoes in the garden and pawpaws and oranges and peaches and things like that. It is harsh. We do get a few hot days in summer, but you still can grow things here.
Lightning Ridge resident Ashley Steed proving to reporter Sally Bryant that you can grow fish and fresh veggies in a harsh outback climate. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, we're camp drafting in the Kimberley. And it's the moment of truth for cattle producers in Queensland in the lead up to their royal show, the Ekka.
It's just gorgeous. When it's separating like that and the fat's all melted, it's just yum, yum.
What would you rate that one, John?
Good, but not as good as we've had.
Was that because of the cooking?
No.
It all comes down to this. A mouthful of beef cooked to exacting requirements in the kitchens of the Brisbane showgrounds. It's the all-important taste-testing day in the annual paddock-to-pallet competition, the Queensland's premier agricultural show, the Ekka. And let me tell you, a lot is riding on this beef being cooked to perfection.
About 2 minutes, I'll just whip them straight off, get them on a resting plate for 2 minutes.
Hello, I'm Craig Zonka. There's 4 stages to this hard-fought contest. Cattle are judged on their weight gain in a feedlot, the look of the carcass hanging up in the abattoir is next, then the quality of the meat according to a Meat Standards Australia report card, and finally, the best bit, the all-important taste test. 3 leading Brisbane restaurateurs are among the judges waiting for these meaty morsels to arrive. But it's all in here, in the kitchen, where there's intense concentration.
Top down as soon as you can, so it's easily cooked from top and bottom.
John Mays, a food scientist from the Department of Agriculture, is with his colleagues. They are in charge of the grill, but they're not firing up the barbecue. They're instead using what looks to be a high-tech sandwich press to cook the meat.
The sandwich press just gives its accuracy. It's really well controlled, heat evenly across the pan and the top, so we get exactly 200 degrees, and it's got a timer so we can't muck up and we know exactly when to take it off. You know, 10 seconds makes a difference over on the cutting tray.
What cut of meat is being used?
Sirloin strip loin.
And it's cooked to what, medium, medium rare?
Medium rare. A bit short of medium rare, just a little bit rare. The judges like it a bit rare, being judges.
Well, let's follow the journey of this steak from inside the kitchen here, and we'll head out to where the judges are tasting sample after sample. You can still hear the sizzle, and the aroma in here is fantastic. Or at least it is for me, but I've only been in here for 5 minutes. For these guys cooking, it might be a different story by the end of the day. Oh no, John's shaking his head. He's loving every minute of it. Okay, let's go out through the door into the judging room, where you do feel like you need to whisper ever so slightly because it's very quiet. So we're out here with the judges.
Glenn Barrett, Wild Canary.
Richard Ousby, Stokehouse.
Josh Lopez, Goma.
Okay, Glenn Barrett, what are you looking for when you taste this little tiny piece of steak that comes out on the plate?
Tenderness, juiciness, flavour, and then overall appeal.
So it hits your palate and you want all that juice to sort of almost spill out of your mouth and, you know, a big smile on your face. That's what I'm looking for.
How many times have you had that smile on your face then?
A couple of times, actually. Yesterday was absolutely like some really stellar meat, and today I'm really excited. 70-day grain-fed today. It's going to be great.
70-day grain-fed meat today. Josh, Richard was talking about that juiciness factor. What is it for you? All about the flavour?
Agreed. Yeah, it has to be about flavour. I will compromise a little bit of tenderness to have ultimate flavour.
When you're tasting wine, you sort of have earthy tones and so on. What should you be tasting when you cut into a piece of meat, Glenn Barrett?
Very similar, sort of, I mean, different herbaceous notes, different sort of mineral elements, saltiness, the flavour of the fat as well, to a certain extent. The caramelisation on the pan, which will be sort of like, you know, either genetic or the weight, or the way that the fat's structured through the meat as well, is very important. But it definitely helps with the cooking. The guys have actually nailed it this year as far as like the continual sort of repetition of cooking each steak, so it's exactly the same, which makes it easier to sort of judge.
Well, I've just been in the kitchen with the food scientists who are using these sort of sandwich press type grill things to try to maintain that consistency throughout, because that would be the toughest thing when you're cutting or cooking, what is it, 150-odd steaks. How the blazes do you do that? Richard, that's almost a Friday night at your restaurant, isn't it?
We do cook a lot of steaks, and thankfully we don't have those sort of, well, maybe we should buy them actually, because they're pretty damn good, these guys. I mean, I've got someone that we've trained up forever, so I mean, maybe we should get some sandwich presses.
But it is surprising, when the meat comes out, literally, it's a little cube about an inch in length, stands about, what, the thickness of the meat seems to be 1.5 centimetres, something like
that. Yeah, absolutely.
Josh, how can you really differentiate between one piece and the next? By the end of the day, does it all start to taste the same?
Look, I think you've really got to enjoy your meat. I've done this, so this is my third year of doing it, and I am very passionate about tasting good beef, and my palate doesn't get too much fatigue. I think judging cheese or wine would be a lot more difficult when you've got flavour overload, but they give us a beautiful apple and crackers just to cleanse the palate in between, and we're not obliged to swallow all the meat, so we do actually spit some out.
You spit some out? Oh, gosh, I feel so sorry for all the grazies that are listening. No, well, Glenn hasn't been. There you go.
At least over a kilo of meat, I say. But no, it was all really good.
Over a kilo of meat. Gosh, you're putting on almost as much as the cattle did when they were in the feedlot. I think the top pen was putting on about 3 kilos a day,
yeah,
which is just absolutely phenomenal. Okay, Richard, cleansing the palate, how important is that as far as the tasting is concerned?
Really important. I mean, I had my first coffee this morning, and then I've just rested my palate since about 6:30 a.m. So it's ready to go. And you really, you got to be conscious of it, because you don't want to put the wrong score. I mean, it's someone's not livelihood on the line, but it's their reputation.
I don't see any sauce either. No tomato sauce. No barbecue sauce. This is just straight steak.
Yeah, no salt, nothing.
Josh, the winning steak, will it end up on your menu?
I hope so. I hope so. We don't know the results until they get announced during the show, but yep. Look forward to seeing and hopefully promoting, you know, what we think's Queensland's best beef.
Okay, well, after
looking at what the judges are doing and seeing the steak cooked in the kitchen. I can't leave here without tasting just a little bit myself. So this is a sirloin. Here we go. So there's no seasoning, no salt and pepper, no Tommy tomato sauce going on this either. Here we go, straight in. Oh, wow. That's a pretty good piece of steak, isn't it? Mmm. Just delicious. So, juiciness factor, probably a 16 out of 20, I'll go. Tenderness, oh, it does have a bit of a chew factor there, so maybe I'll go 11 out of 20 for tenderness. But the flavour, oh, wow. As Josh Lomez from Goma was talking about, flavour critical. So I'll go a 32 out of 40, yeah, 40 points on offer for flavour. Overall liking, oh, delicious. I'll go an 8 out of 10 for overall liking this piece of steak. It could be one of the winners, you never know, in the Paddock to Palate competition for 2015.
Oh, it's awesome. I love camp drafting. It's the best sport in the world. It dates back when we first started ringing and droving and stuff like that. And the ringers used to make up this as a game to them. And then they started professionally doing it as a sport. And it's just got bigger and bigger since then. And I just think, what a better way to promote our industry and what we do and what we love doing with our horses and stuff.
You can hear it in her voice. Kayla Struber just loves the sport of camp drafting. And she's not alone. More than 700 drafters converged on the small Kimberley town of Halls Creek in the far north of Western Australia to show off their horse riding and cattle handling skills. G'day, I'm Tom Edwards. To the untrained eye, camp drafting doesn't look all that exciting. A horse and rider guiding a single beast round a set course on a dusty arena. But looks can be deceiving. Horse and rider must work as a team, against the clock, to earn top marks. And if you fail to impress the judges, you'll hear this sound. And it's game over.
It's my second course in my whole life. And this is her third ever camp draft run. So I'm stoked. Absolutely. I think I've got an 83 altogether. So that's awesome. Not quite the finals, but it was up there. It was really good. G'day, my name's Kayla Struber and I'm from Rosewood Station.
What do you think about the turnout here at Halls Creek?
It's always a good show at Halls Creek. Every year we come here, we always have a good time. It's always really well organised and yeah, just a great atmosphere. Everyone's so friendly, it's beautiful. You can't get any better than this. Kimberley Camp Drafting is the best, I reckon.
But what goes through your mind when you're out there?
Oh, you try and focus and stuff and just remember what everybody's ever taught you and stuff like that. Just try your best, I guess.
What is it that you love so much about it?
This has been a sport that me, my dad, my brothers, we've all done it, and just important, yeah, really important to us. It's something that, you know, you can do with your horse, and you got to have a good bond with your horse, otherwise you can't do any good, because your horse has got to trust you, and you got to trust them sometimes to make the right decisions. And yeah, I just love being with my horses. And
tell me about your horse.
This is a bit of alright, her name is, and she's only a young horse now, but yeah, like I said, that's her third ever camp draft run, so she's doing fantastic. Yeah, she's an energetic little bugger, but she's beautiful.
You've travelled a long way to be here. What is it that makes you make the effort?
It's about everyone coming together and having a good time, and it doesn't matter the distance because you always have a good weekend.
Seems to be an even spread of ages taking part. Do you think that a lot of younger people are being attracted to camp drafting now?
Oh, definitely, and the parents have got a big influence upon that as well. You know, if your parents have camp drafted, chances are you will too. Like my dad, he's into it and we're all into it. The boys don't do it as much anymore, but they had a go at it when they were younger. And it's good to see the younger kids getting into it as well. Can only get bigger and better, I reckon.
And a lot of women as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's a big thing for girls. Like the ladies draft is up next and it's going to be huge and full on.
Kayla Struber, obviously enjoying all the action at the Halls Creek Camp Draft, and what a great name for a horse, a bit of all right. Tom Edwards has put some fabulous photographs from the Camp Draft on the Rural website. Do yourself a favour and check them out, abc.net.au/rural.